I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times.
Our job is to create a Democratic Party, a grassroots party, where decisions are made from the bottom on up, not from the top on down.
And that's the familiar voice of Senator Bernie Sanders speaking in Portland, Maine last month, along with Tom Perez, the Democratic National Committee chairman, on their unity tour to rally Democrats and disaffected voters. Sanders was loudly cheered by the crowd, as you can hear, while there were some boos mixed in with cheers for Perez and mention of the DNC. After the rally, MSNBC host Chris Hayes asked Sanders if he was a Democrat, and he replied, "No, I'm an independent." And that tells you a lot about the health and future of the Democratic Party that is a shadow of its former self. After losing the White House in 2016, remaining the minority party in the U.S. Congress and in most state legislatures, and losing governorships in recent years. Today on Radio Times, why have the Democrats been the losing party and what can they do to win back voters? We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Matt Karp is an assistant professor of history at Princeton University, also contributing editor at Jacobin, and that's a left-wing magazine. And Matt Karp, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's an honor to be here.
Thank you so much. TJ Rooney is with us as well, former chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. He also represented the 131st District in the Pennsylvania State House. He's now a partner with the Rooney Novak Group doing government relations. And TJ Rooney, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's nice to be here.
We could spend the whole hour on Hillary Clinton. I do not want to do that. There is so much more to talk about. But she, it needs to be said, she won the popular vote. She lost the Electoral College, and that's how White Houses are won or lost. How much, though, TJ, do you think she represents problems with the Democratic Party?
I think Secretary Clinton's problems were uniquely her own. I don't think that they speak to listen, there are larger issues that we need to address in the Democratic Party. Anytime you are the out party, your chasms, your divides are laid bare before the world to see. So that's not to be unexpected. But in looking at this over a period of time now, I've in my mind believe that Hillary's flaws were in fact fatal going into the race. That her longevity, which should have been her greatest asset in a lot of respects, was her greatest liability. The familiarity, the idea of going back. We heard a lot of it. We heard a lot of it, of course, from the Sanders folks.
Sure.
And then, of course, we heard – but before it all started, before there was a Bernie Sanders, there was talk of kind of Clinton fatigue. Remember, in the same context as Jeb Bush, you know, we don't want to go back there. Those issues were a lot deeper and more profound in voters' minds than I think we had given or given them short shrift in that respect by not paying closer attention.
How do you see it, Matt? And then we'll move on from Hillary.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. What TJ says is right, I think. I remember there was a lot of talk during the primary that Hillary had been so beaten up by the Republicans over the course of the past 20 years that her unfavorability couldn't possibly go lower. She had been so brutally attacked and her image had been so broken that would be a strength in the general election. That turned out not to be the case. Yeah. I will say, though, just briefly, that to be in the strange position of defending Hillary Clinton, even as a strong believer that Bernie would have won the general election, I think that the problems do go a lot deeper. I think if you're talking about the kind of historic losses over the last 8 years at the state level, that's something that began before Hillary, and I don't think it's been fixed yet.
In fact, let me add to what you just said there, Matt, and this is under President Obama. The Democratic Party lost, I believe, 11 Senate seats, 14 governorships, and something like 900 state legislative seats. So clearly, the Democratic Party was in deep trouble, TJ Rooney, under President Obama.
You have to pay attention to it, and it becomes priorities. And I think when you there begins to become some sort of a complacency when you have the White House, especially when you're in the second term of a White House, you've got to make investments. It's like anything else, any other enterprise or any garden you may grow, and unless you tend to it, unless you water it and feed it. It's gonna wither and die, and that's what happened. The DNC was fat and robust, and everybody had a job and a fancy black car to drive around the district. The problem was we were making that our priority. What gave were legislature, the Democratic mm-hmm. Legislative Committee. I love the DLCC. I was involved in them for 100 years.
But it was very centrist.
Yes. I mean, it was.
It stole Republican ideas.
The party itself is reflective of what you allow it to become. And it became fat, dumb, and happy. And when that occurs, you're going, something's got to give. And in this case, it was down ballot. Races and state-centric races just weren't perhaps mm-hmm. given the time, effort, energy, and attention they were entitled to and needed.
Well, Matt, let me turn to you. And TJ, I want to hear from you as well. I mean, parties are always coalitions of people that don't necessarily belong in the same box together, but there they are. What do you think it means to be a Democrat today? What do Democrats believe in?
Well, I think that's in some ways you put your finger precisely on the button, or rather maybe the absence of a button, because I don't think Democrats have a coherent positive identity today. I think so much. I mean, one of the issues with the Clinton campaign, but was not limited to the Clinton campaign, was the Democrats identified themselves as the party of love trumps hate. They literally put the opponent's name in their number one slogan. The party of not being the Republicans, of not being the monster under the bed, of not being vulgar and indecorous and perhaps racist like the Republicans. But without, I think the Clinton campaign was maybe the apotheosis of this, but I think since 2008, Democrats have really struggled to identify what kind of popular, positive programs they might have. And for me, that's why the Sanders campaign was so exciting and refreshing, because it represented a break with that sort of reluctance to proclaim a positive program of, how we can reshape this economy in a democratic way so that it works for all Americans rather than just for the 1%.
But it's interesting, and I said this during the campaign, and people will get angry at me for saying, but Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. I mean, he says he's not a Democrat, and yet he's sort of, in many ways, Matt, represents these progressive democratic ideas.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, for me, the outstanding economic fact of our time is the concentration of wealth and power, and really beyond wealth, economic power in the hands of a very small few wealthy elite. I mean, if you just look at the chart of American productivity over the last 40 years, I mean, the economy hasn't really stagnated. I mean, we have miniature computers in our pockets, right? We've done things that the 1970s were unimaginable, and yet wages, real hourly wages, are really stagnant since the late 70s, basically for the bottom 90%. The gains have been lapped up by the people at the top. And the Democratic Party, I think, has been missing in action on a lot of those fronts, has been ideologically, institutionally unwilling to commit itself to sort of fighting for an economy that believing that the economy can be shaped by using democratic means to benefit everybody, as opposed to this handful of elites.
Well, TJ, just to pick up on some of what Matt was just saying there, there's the issue of income inequality. There's certainly, we've got working poor, which is always, it sticks in my craw to say those words, to think that you could be working and poor in this country. The issue of child care, health care, as much as the Affordable Care Act brought some people into the system, it didn't really solve so many of the problems of our health care system. Education, I mean, it seems that the Democrats have a lot that they could run on.
Sure. And the thing that is most important, I think, that we keep in mind is that the things that might separate from in a philosophical way Matt and myself are minuscule in comparison to those that divide Matt and I from the other side. So though all of those issues, you're right, perhaps they've been given not the time and attention that they deserve. And maybe the fight hasn't been as vigorous as others would see. But make no, you can't make any mistake. Those are Democratic issues. Those issues are spoken to in legislative chambers and in the Congress of the United States virtually every day. The problem is there's not enough of us to make a difference at the moment.
Well, that's interesting. Matt, I know you want to say something. Let me just play one clip here. And this is a Democratic Party chair, Tom Perez. He's speaking on Meet the Press. It was a couple months ago, February 27th.
Well, I think we have to underscore that economic message. In Ohio, I went out there, I talked to voters, and what they heard from Donald Trump is, I'm going to bring your coal jobs back. That's a lie. But what they heard is that he felt their pain. What they heard from us was that, we vote for us because we're not him. And we have to make sure we're communicating our affirmative message.
What do you think about that, Matt?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good sign to the extent that, you know, Perez or Democratic leadership is recognizing that dynamic in the election that, I remember Governor Rendell, for instance, had a very different view of we'll lose a blue collar Democrat here. We'll get two suburban moderates there. I hope that this means that they've junked that idea. But I think in a deeper level, it's not just about talking about economics. I think it's about advancing a vision in some concrete sense about what a different kind of economy might look like. So, for instance, I mean, and this is, if you talk about these, TJ says these are Democratic issues.
Right.
I think we forget to the extent to which so many things that are traditionally Democratic issues have dropped by the wayside in the last 30 years. And this is where it is deeper than Clinton. I mean, for across the middle decades of the 20th century, the number one issue on the Democratic platform every year was something called full employment, right? This idea that it's possible through Keynesian economics, through fiscal policy, but essentially it's possible to democratically manage the economy such that every American should have the opportunity to have a job. That language, starting in the sort of in the 80s and then especially in the Clinton era, really dropped away. It has not really come back, even with Bernie. I think, Bernie would be sympathetic to this, but I think there's so much more room in the direction of policy, but in the direction of just thinking about universal public goods and rights, like every American should have a job. That doesn't even, to me, sound like a distinctly left-wing activist proposition that can speak to a lot of the values about the fruits of your labor and the dignity of work that, Republicans often talk about. And I think these issues like that would register are extremely popular. Polling suggests that they are. But Democrats don't hesitate, I think, and we can talk maybe about what the issue is here, but I think the ideological timidity about really thinking that the Democratic government can exert control over the economy beyond just greasing the wheels to make it a little bit more efficient, but actually guaranteeing people a job, for instance, is something that the party's gone away from.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here, but TJ, I mean, what's wrong with talking about it that way?
Nothing. 100% nothing wrong. But what I would respectfully submit is that I think when you talk about going to good places like that, what gets in the way is the reality of our politics. And that's just not Democratic politics. I mean, our politics in general. And I think one issue that would kind of demonstrate that in the campaign was the whole issue of college education and affordability of said education. And there was a disparity between Hillary Clinton. There was animosity at times between Hillary and Senator Sanders. And the animosity, I think, on Hillary's part was born from the fact that it's great. We would love to do it. How in God's name is it possible? So that those are the kinds of things that I think at times get in our way of thinking and talking bigger and better.
Well, let me pick up on that after this very short break, talking with TJ Rooney and Matt Karp about the Democratic Party, the challenges that it faces. And you can join our conversation. Call 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been talking about how the Democratic Party is in trouble and what to do about it. TJ Rooney, former chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. He's currently a partner in the Rooney Novak Group, and that's a government relations organization. Matt Karp is with us as well, assistant professor of history at Princeton University. He's also contributing editor at Jacobin. That's how we found him, and that's, as he describes it, a left-wing magazine. TJ, you said something really interesting right before the break, which is that the sort of pragmatics, which is to say, picking up on what Matt said, we want full employment. You're saying, while that's a great thing to aspire to, it's not practically possible. So I wonder whether the Democratic Party has sort of lost its ability to inspire people, even for things that might not 100% come true.
Yeah, each election is a beast unto itself. I think our fate and fortune will be very much different in the 2018 elections. But yeah, no, I was making the point in the sense that there are, and Matt's right, there are a lot of important things that we have as a party stood for and stand for. We don't speak to the things that perhaps we did at one time. And again, my point is that I think that the politics of reality cloud the situations and get in the way. Because even if you ask the most liberal member of Congress or legislature, you know, if they would like to do it, of course, everybody does. But can you? I mean, that's where the problem kind of.
Well, that's interesting. What do you say, Matt?
Well, I mean, I think this gets to this, not to take us back to the primary, but there was that, you know, that moment in that was so striking in the campaign between Clinton and Sanders, where she said, you know, where she was talking about the idea of, you know, single payer health care, Medicare for all. And she said, you know, why should we fight for something that will never, ever happen in our lifetime? And I think that was incredibly frustrating to a lot of people in the Sanders world. And I think in a broader sense, you know, it can't happen if you don't want to make it happen. If the sort of supposed party of left of center in the United States is, you know, actively opposed to it, it certainly cannot happen. I mean, that you pulled it out of bounds right away.
That almost gets to your Rendell. And you're right. It was a ham-handed analogy, if there ever was a ham-handed analogy. But the credibility is because when you ask for things and when you suggest to people, it's providing that false hope that we just heard in the clip about coal mining jobs to a lot of folks. And I understand that it may ring differently depending upon, you know, the person's ear, but I think that's what it speaks. It speaks to this kind of like I'd rather tell people the truth and be content and know that I can deliver on that than to set the bar so high that it's impossible in our life, you know.
And potentially disappoint people.
Exactly. Like letting people down is I think this president is going to come to experience. Raising people's hope. And I'm not saying Bernie Sanders did this in any way, shape, or form in the way that the president has. But I think when you raise people's hopes and dash their expectations, the bottom becomes a lot lower.
Oh, interesting. Go ahead, Matt. And then I do want to read a bunch of comments.
Sure. Two things. On the point of raising hopes, I mean, I just want to say that if you don't lay out a vision, and especially during a primary campaign, I mean, you know, that is a time to sort of lay out a vision for what is possible. But on a more fundamental level, in terms of, I think one of the main problems with the Democratic Party in the last 40 years is this almost unthinking sort of narrowing of the sense of what is possible based on a kind of belief that the kind of, you know, what I would say is a kind of increasingly dominant belief that we can only accept what the market will produce for us, that we have as a society, we have a limited ability to control this system, which the economy is separate somehow from politics, and that all of this kind of major trends of the last 40 years, like the decline of unions, the kind of stagnation of wages, the concentration of wealth in the hands of the 1%, that these things are somehow separate from politics and are determined, you know, almost as a technical matter by the economy, when in fact these are all questions of power. These are all questions of the way in which, you know, sure, there are global economic trends that, you know, we have robots now, we have automation in industry, but why do we take it for granted that the sort of rewards, the kind of increased productivity from those robots should flow only to the owners of those robots rather than to all of us? And I think these are questions that we have to debate actively as a society in our democracy, not just leave bracket as an economic question that we can't actually deliver on, but these things should be the things that we're actually arguing about.
I know you have something to say. Let me just read some comments, and there's much more. This is fascinating. Let me read some comments that came into the show. This is from Carson. He said, many younger Democratic-leaning voters I know are still very upset about how they think the DNC treated Bernie Sanders and his followers. This has done tremendous damage to the the Democratic brand. Teresa says that's a good way to put it. We need to read the tea leaves. The Dems are too rigid. I have lost my party. Robert Post says, well, at least NPR is concerned about the Democrats and doing what they can to help rebuild. What will we do without NPR? I think that was a little snarky comment. And I will just say, we did a show about the Republican Party in Philadelphia, which barely exists. Basically, a one-party town, talking about why we need to have two functioning parties. Aaron says we need to board the Bernie bus before the rest of the party leaves without them. Jason says the Bernie-crat Quist lost the race, so I would not be touting any Bernie bus right now. Seems like it has a flat tire. So those are certainly some of the opinions that are out there. Let me play some more clips. And this is Jennifer Palmieri. She's a former Clinton-Obama aide, and she appeared on Meet the Press February 13th.
A lot of this energy is not the base is there, but you are wrong to look at these crowds and think that means everyone wants $15 an hour. Don't assume that the answer to big crowds is moving policy to the left.
And let me play another clip. This is Nancy Pelosi speaking alongside the Democratic Party leaders last week.
And I'll tell you one thing for sure. We win the election in the first 100 hours, we will pass a $15 minimum wage.
So TJ Rooney, looks like a $15 minimum wage is coming, at least as far as the Democrats are concerned.
There's a lot needs to occur before that can become a reality. We have to win majorities.
Is that a good aspiration?
Oh, absolutely, 100% it is. I mean, you know, and quite frankly, how in the heck can anybody live on $15? I mean, that's not nearly enough.
Well, you can't.
But, right. I mean, so, like, I don't understand why people.
Can I get you on the record on that? Yeah,
oh,
we need $20, TJ.
You know, make it $150. I think that, of course, there are. I do understand Jennifer's point, though, about crowds. And if you just indulge me 30 seconds,
sure.
Not even, less than that, I'll give you a story about crowds. It was Hillary's campaign in 2008, and Senator Obama had a rally the Friday before Friday or Saturday. Maybe it was the weekend. It was Saturday night before.
So they were running against each other.
Right across the street. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And the rally was across the street. And it was I picked up the papers the next morning, and there were 40,000 people turned out at this rally in Independence Hall on behalf of Senator Obama.
I think I was there.
You probably
I think I was there. I think Will I Am was there.
Yeah.
I think Ed Kowalczyk from Live. He has a good, you know, anyway. Yeah.
The memories are flooding back. Yeah, go ahead, TJ.
I had occasion to speak to the governor the next morning. We were involved in the Hillary series. And I said, holy smokes, we are going to get the living tar kicked out of us. The crowds don't vote. But the point was that I understand Jennifer's point, and I understand his more gruff, brusque point is that it's important. Crowds tell a story, but sometimes the story they tell isn't exactly the one that you think you're reading.
And we've had a lot of crowds over the last couple of years. Matt, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. Just on the Palmieri line. I mean, I think that's absolutely right that, you know, crowds, I think what TJ said is the right way of thinking about it. Crowds tell one story that is important. It's not the only story. But I think, you know, Palmieri is off, you know, is dreaming if she thinks that there isn't a solid Democratic, you know, majority in support of a lot of these programs that, you know, are typically in the media discussed as left-wing ideas. I mean, if you look at something like recently the polls on should the government guarantee health care for every American, it's polling reliably. Even when you put in the evil G word, government, even when you phrase it that way, you're getting 60% of Americans in support. And same thing with massive raises in the minimum wage, strict regulation of Wall Street. I think in the 60% of Americans think that corporations make too many profits and that the rich should be taxed more. These are all sort of left-wing Bernie-crat issues that have a reliable and very healthy majority that I think people like Palmieri de-emphasize not entirely because they don't want to win elections, but because they don't want to disrupt important stakeholders and institutional power brokers in their own party.
The Goldman Sachs of the world,
I mean,
that kind of thing?
The truth is the Wall Street is not property of the Republicans. The Democrats are equally invested in a lot of ways in the last 30 years in the Wall Street vision of the economy. The Clinton campaign represented that. So I think that's disingenuous, and I think it's actively harmful when you deny the reality that there's broad, not rather than just narrow, activist support for a lot of these bread and butter issues.
And that's Matt Karp, who joins us along with TJ Rooney. We're talking about the Democratic Party, a losing party, if I can put it that way, over the last 8 years or so, and some of the issues, challenges facing the party. I've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me just toss out a couple of things here. You mentioned Ed Rendell. I don't know how old he is, but Bernie Sanders is 75, Hillary Clinton is 69, Elizabeth Warren is 67, Dianne Feinstein is 83, Nancy Pelosi is 77, Steny Hoyer is 77, Jerry Brown is 79. TJ, are these people just going to age?
Make me feel like a kid. I'm starting to feel
but
all right
these,
again.
You know, these are old heads, right?
Sure they are. Sure.
I'm not being ageist here. I'm just saying the leaders of the party, including Elizabeth Warren, are not spring chickens.
They're mature. No, there's no question about it. And sure, we have to grow our party. And that's how we really started the conversation. You know, when the resources are devoted to one area and other areas are left bare, i.e. the state legislatures and statewide row officers, you know, that's what you get. So, but make no mistake, the party is not devoid of bright, shining stars, mm-hmm. be it here in Pennsylvania or be it across the country. So, yes, Marty, and the fact of the matter is, generally speaking, the political states people are typically more mature than they're not. So
you chose that word very wisely, carefully.
It's a it's a reality, but I don't think it's a phenomenon.
Anything you want to add to that, Matt? Then we'll get Elliot from Mount Airy to join us.
I mean, I would just say on the question of I have heard the Democratic Party described as a gerontocracy, and I think there is some truth to that. I think I think one thing that was so notable about the Sanders campaign is that polls have continued to show this, is that the most sort of progressive chunk of this country are people under 35
sure.
or so,
sure.
And I think the future, to the extent if there is one for the Democratic Party, requires connecting with those voters and bringing them out. Which I don't think happened in 2016.
Let's see what looks like Elliot from Mount Airy has to say. Elliot, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I think the Democratic Party has forgotten to be proactive and basically has no strategy and no core message. And so I've written a proposal that the core message, I don't want to get into all the details.
No, please don't. Sorry, Elliot. Go ahead.
The core idea is the concept of responsible government, and the idea of we are the party of government, but responsible government, that we ought to. And that changes the message away from the Republican message, which is government is bad. I think we need to have a message that government is good and that it can be responsible and help people develop a better quality of life.
Fair enough.
So I'd like to hear the comments of the
sure.
Of the people you have about that idea.
Elliot, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. TJ,
any problem with that? No, of course not. Our message needs to be hopeful, aspirational, and optimistic. And Elliot's right in suggesting that what we saw in the last election didn't meet those marks. But I will also say that I am not nearly as down on our party as some folks are. Remember, it was about 3 days before the November election when I turned on the TV the weekend before, and all I heard was the postmortem being done on the Republican cadaver and how the Republican Party was forever going to be relegated to and then 3 days later, surprise, he jumps out of the cake. And now we're, here we are. So we definitely, I agree with Matt and with Elliot. We have issues, but they're not nearly as bad as some have made them out to be.
Matt, let me put a question to you and kind of phrase it this way, maybe picking up on what Elliot said. Do you think the Democratic Party in the U.S. needs to act more like Europe?
I don't actually
in terms
like to,
of social safety net services.
I mean, to be honest, from 30,000 miles up, in the atmosphere, absolutely yes. I mean, every other developed nation has universal health care, some kind of single payer system, a Medicare for all idea. There's no reason that, as Bernie Sanders says, we are the richest society in the history of civilization, that we can't do this. It's not to say that it will be easy or that it will be painless, but there's no reason why people should be literally dying because they can't afford health insurance. So in that sense, I guess I do somewhat resist the formulation that we need to be more like Europe, because mm-hmm. I think there are roots within the American political tradition from President Lincoln onward, as Lincoln famously said, right, labor is prior to and independent of capital, right? I mean, part of what this is now getting to my putting my historian hat on, but part of what the Civil War, what the early Republican Party itself was founded on was opposition to slavery, which was at the time a kind of fundamental centerpiece of the American economy beyond all of its other dimensions. And the Republicans, what they said in the 1850s was, look, this economy is actually not working for us as a democratic society. We can change it. We can say this rule, this right to property should be put on the road to ultimate extinction. Hmm. We can prioritize labor, that is the labor of slaves and free white workers, over the capital investment in slavery. So this is maybe a little bit of a stretch as an analogy, but I think there's no question that there's a deep history in the United States of believing that the, to go to Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal, to go to Martin Luther King in the, not just the Civil Rights Movement, but then the Poor People's Campaign, in believing that we have an ability to sort of create an economy that works for all of us, that puts labor above capital. And I don't think that, when you frame it as a European idea, I don't think that actually appeals to people.
I know, I hear you. I mean, does that make sense to you? We have gone through dramatic transformations in this country, whether it was Martin Luther King or where the Industrial Revolution, unions, all of that. Is that still part of our future, TJ?
Sure it is. Because it's part of our DNA. And believe me, I couldn't match wits in terms of history with Matt any day of the week. But we have in our nation's past gone through times that are seemingly a little bit rudderless, seemingly a little bit cockamamie, seemingly a little chaotic,
scary.
If we turned on the television this morning, I mean, it's we're going through a very, very unusual period in our nation's history. I think it will ultimately be cathartic, and I think it will ultimately add to our strengths. Because when we are tried as a nation, we typically respond with a steel spine. And I think what I really do believe we are going through a fascinating time, and it's going to result in dramatic change. And I'm hopeful and optimistic that change will inure to our collective benefit
as
Democrats.
TJ Rooney, former chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. He's a partner with the Rooney Novak Group. That's a government relations enterprise. Also with us, assistant professor of history at Princeton University, Matt Karp. He's also a contributing editor at Jacobin. We are talking about the Democratic Party. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. I've been talking with Matt Karp and TJ Rooney about why the Democratic Party has been on the losing end of recent elections, what they have to do to stay relevant. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Before we hear from Eric, let me just read a couple of comments. A tweet, Sanders would do for the Democratic Party what Jerry Corbyn did for labor, essentially sink the party. An email from Mark, gerrymandering, most recently accomplished by Republicans, assure safe seats for right-wing representatives. I will jump down here. I will digest some of this. Let's take Eric from Pennsylvania, and I can just figure out what else is on my other screen here. Eric, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I think it's fine to talk about fine-tuning issues, but I think we do a great disservice if we ignore tactics. You know, we're dealing with the Republican Party that seems to be ruthlessly interested in power at any cost. You got to look at gerrymandering, dark money, voter suppression, a hostile foreign power, a.k.a. Russia, involved in our elections, with the likelihood of collusion with some of the Republicans. Democrats win votes. We don't always win our elections.
Well, that's interesting. TJ, do you want to take that?
Yeah.
You put a lot on the table there.
No, it's definitely a full plate. And all of those issues are important and relevant. The good news is that, you know, in terms of the outside interference, that's being looked into by five or six different independent or five or six different entities that we hope we have our faith and confidence in. So yeah, I mean, all of the issues that Eric laid out are issues that are important and relevant. There is no, it goes back to kind of what we were saying. I don't think there's any one, if there was any one problem, we would have fixed it back in November. There's a couple things that we need to be paying attention to.
Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, on I think gerrymandering is important. I think another thing that's in line with the caller's point is, you know, vote suppression and kind of Republican efforts, which are only, you know, mounting under this administration to limit access to the ballot. And I think one thing, though, just to not be completely partisan, I think it's true that the Democrats have not made that proactive effort to expand ballot access through automatic registration and so on, that I think now they're sort of moving in that direction, and that's helpful. But I think they've been even Ari Berman, who just wrote a big book on this, Give Us the Ballot, has sort of said that Democrats have been very slow on this, on especially in places like New York, where they kind of would prefer to kind of control who is an electorate and who is not in the electorate. And it gets unpredictable if you bring more people in. But I think bringing more people in is vital to fighting back against Republican tactics.
TJ, let me just toss something at you. Here in Pennsylvania, the Democrats have a huge registration advantage over Republicans. But, you know, Trump won, not by a lot, but he won the state and certainly represented in many ways in Congress and the state legislature by Republicans.
Yeah. And then
what does that tell you?
Well, in one sense, it speaks to the gerrymander. It speaks to how we construct districts, how we draw the lines. And that is definitely in need of revamping. Pennsylvania is
a, is that an enthusiasm gap?
It's a couple of things. In this past election, it was certainly reflected an enthusiasm gap. But, you know, we talked about it a little bit before we went on the air. The irony of this past election, at least in this state, I'm not talking about nationally, but in this state, is that the margins, when the early numbers came in and showed the margins that Hillary was racking up in the city of but also in the suburbs, in the five counties, 9.5 days out of 10, you call that good night, checkmate, game over. So it tells me that our problems are with the voters that Matt has referred to in the sense that, you know, they don't necessarily fit neatly into a box. They are in every corner of Pennsylvania, and they are not just young, energetic people who have lost enthusiasm. They're old, you know, people who have had maybe two or three jobs in their lives who've always voted Democrat that just got sick of it and went the complete other opposite direction.
Let me quote something, because I know you want to say something, Matt, but it was a really interesting article that Michael Tomasky had in the New Republic, and I'll just quote a couple of sentences. And he talked about this coalition in the Democratic Party, basically of kind of professionals and non-white working class people. But he also says there are plenty of liberals out there in middle America and plenty of liberalish moderates and plenty of people who lean conservative but aren't consumed by rage and who think Barack Obama is a pretty cool guy and they might have even voted for him. These people are potential allies, but before the alliance can be struck, elite liberals need to recognize a fundamental truth. All of these people in middle America, even the actual liberals, have very different sensibilities than elite liberals who live in the coast. And he goes on from there, but he's basically saying there's a kind of a snobbery among liberal Democratic elites that might be hurting the party.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this speaks to – it's interesting that Tomasky's talking about this now, because during the primary he was sort of mocking Bernie Sanders because no one who gets 36% in Fairfax County can be president, as if, you know, Fairfax County is like ground zero for the kind of elite professional class that
right.
Now he's sort of distancing himself from. But yeah, I mean, I think the best one-stop source for this is Tom Frank has a book, Listen Liberal, which is a little bit
he
of a
polemic. He was on Radio Times. Yeah,
okay,
John Aaron's
yeah, and he – you know, this is one of the things that's happened to the Democratic Party since it was the party of unions and of full employment. It's become now the party of affluent suburbs to a large extent, tied to a kind of larger working class constituency of non-white people who really have nowhere else to go because the Republican Party is actively not interested in their votes at this point and has become, you know, even less so. But that this coalition, you know, it hasn't been – it was a winning coalition with Obama. It's not – it wasn't a winning coalition under Hillary. And it's, I think, without – in the absence of a kind of broader effort to connect with working Americans of all kinds outside of the suburbs, it's not a majority coalition. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. I cannot disagree with anything you've just said, but it requires, and I'm sure I know Matt has it, an understanding that these very same men and women are that the things that may excite the liberals in the suburbs are exactly the things that cause these men and women in Aliquippa to stick their fingers in their ears and
be
not
specific.
Listen.
In what way?
Truthfully, when.
Is it guns, abortion?
It's all of that. It's just the way that the resonance, the receptivity to the Obama message that was felt in all of these corners that was obviously not felt specifically by people in middle Pennsylvania, if you will. Some of the issues that would ignite and light Matt and probably myself up are some issues that would cause these folks. When you get too far out in front, using healthcare as an example, because a lot of these folks have dealt with the system. They've had coverage. They haven't had coverage. So raising their expectations and speaking in an aspirational way is critical. But their BSometer, if you will, is more finely honed or honed differently in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, than in Abington, Pennsylvania.
Oh, it looks like you want to add something, Matt, and then we'll get Racer to join us.
Yeah, I mean, I agree to a certain extent and about the BSometer. I think that's fair. But I think the biggest thing, I mean, the most brutal irony of the 2016 election is that the Republican Party, the party of plutocracy, literally ran a billionaire for president who still managed to be the quote-unquote populist, who still managed to – so if you want to – I mean, you know – I guess in some ways you could call into question the BSometer of a voter who believed that Trump was really going to push through an agenda of economic populism when now we see his budget and it's basically straight Paul Ryan, plutocratic politics. But the fact is they voted in that direction, I think, because he at least made an attempt to
spoke
sort
to
of,
their issues.
Exactly, to sort of recognize the situation in the economy of many places in America. And the Democrats haven't made that attempt.
Regulation,
but did he speak
Marty,
to their issues or speak to their emotions,
both,
their rage?
Both. And you asked for a very specific example. Let me give you one quick one, and that's regulation, especially as it relates to coal, for example. If you go out to Greene County, Pennsylvania, what he said is never going to be possible, that I'm going to bring your jobs, I'm going to recreate this industry. We may have a strong belief that it's not ever going to be possible. But to those men and women who voted for Barack Obama in previous years and other Democrats along the course of history, it was music to their ears. He mm-hmm. played it like a violin. And that's one area where we would say overregulation, my arse. It's the perfect regulation. People out there, people in Greene County will tell you, that's the end of our job. So what the three of us might view as appropriately regulated industry, they think, you know, we've driven them off the cliff.
Let me get Racer to join our conversation. Racer calling us from Philadelphia. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome. Go ahead.
What I wanted to, in 2012, after Barack Obama's victory, the Republican Party said that they needed to change their message, and they did no such thing. So, frankly, doesn't that prove that people don't vote for messages or really even parties? They vote for candidates?
It's such a good question, and I think, TJ, you were on with Alan Novak speaking to this question probably 12 years ago that the racer raised.
Candidates. He's right. It matters so much for exactly what we're seeing. That we would, if the cake hadn't been baked as hard as it was, Hillary Clinton should, you know, blah, blah, blah. If my grandmother'd wheel, she'd be a bicycle. But the fact of the matter is the unfavorable, we couldn't get out of the way of those unfavorables. Mm-hmm. Where Matt and I would part company is that I don't think if you had, at Bernie Sanders had led the party in the national election, the result would have been any different. But, mm-hmm. but the unfavorable, the caller, Racer is right, the candidate matters tremendously.
Matt, hold on. Let me put an email to you, okay? And she says, you all have talked for 39 minutes without even a mention of the party's most loyal voters, African-Americans. Is the party running away from these loyal voters? Didn't 94% of African-American women vote for Clinton? Where's the discussion about how to increase turnout of your most loyal voters? And that's a really good point.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this does speak to something that I've written about a little bit is, yeah, the if you look at African-American turnout in 2016, I mean, it was very loyal to the Democrats, but it was unenthusiastic. And in a lot of places, especially in working class African-American areas, it really sagged, just on the ward level in a place like, Philadelphia or Washington, significant drop. And some of that is just, okay, the Obama effect, you know, he's a magnetic, candidates matter. But I think it also speaks to, there's been some really good reporting on this. There's a great New York Times article about these black barbers in Milwaukee. And they're saying, you know, we've been trying this for 8 years. None of it's been working. Give us jobs. Give us a loan. Give us something that will speak to our. I think people sometimes bracket African American voters in a sort of category where economic issues are somehow in a sort of a separate sphere from African American or Latino voters. Like these people vote entirely based on identity. I think that's a deep, deep mistake. And I think a broad message of universal public goods, jobs, healthcare for everybody are messages that really register with working class African American voters too.
TJ, let me read an email from Beverly. He says, an immediate issue with the Democratic Party's attempt to rejuvenate and reorganize is the DNC chairperson Tom Perez's foul mouth. He's turning people off rather than stimulating involvement, and he does throw the F-bomb around.
Yeah, thank goodness they never put me in that chair.
Would you follow in his footsteps?
Oh, I'm profane to the hilt.
You've been very good today.
I'm definitely keeping it in check. You're nice people. You can't. If you're going to deliver a thoughtful, concise, poignant message, you can't be foul-mouthing it up.
Here's an email from Daniel. Hillary's campaign was the proverbial chain of catastrophe. Remove any link and the chain fails. The Comey letter, the private server, the basket of deplorables comment. No one on election day thought she was going to lose, certainly not Donald Trump. Matt?
Yeah, I mean, you can over-explain Clinton's defeat. But again, I think it's deeper than – I mean, this is maybe – I think it's deeper than Clinton. I mean, these state legislature numbers, Republicans, I think now the Democratic Party is now weakest at the state level, weaker than at the state level than it's been since the Civil War. That's not just about the Comey letter. I think we can't neglect this this deeper phenomenon that's taking place and that the Democratic Party's inability to answer the fundamental – I think economic questions of our day are you can't look away from that.
But TJ, thinking about local level, that's the long game, isn't it? That
sure.
You get people the dog catcher, you know, local government, and then they work their way.
You have to invest, and you have to invest in it. You're so right. I mean, we got our head handed to us in the legislature, in large part because of reapportionment, but also when you look at the respective, like in House Democrats in Pennsylvania legislature, House Democratic Campaign Committee needs to be well-funded. They need to be able to go out and recruit candidates. They need to give candidates training. They need to get candidates on the ballot. And if any one of those, and you have the same counterpart in the Senate in Pennsylvania, if any one of those pieces doesn't have what it needs, mm-hmm. then you're going to lose. It wasn't a devolution. It was the money from D.C. did not continue to flow to state parties in the way that it should have under the previous administration.
That's interesting. We're almost out of time here, Matt. You mentioned something earlier, sort of the question hanging out there. If there is a Democratic Party in the future, do you think it's in that deep trouble?
I mean, I think there's a reckoning. I think we're definitely due for a deep reckoning. And I think the nature of our political structure in this country, you know, constitutionally, means that, you know, gravitates towards a two-party system. So, you know, historically, there have been moments where, you know, third parties have broken up or third parties have entered, but it hasn't lasted. So I think it's hard to believe that there's going to be anything other than a two-party system. What that two-party system looks like, what issues the two parties stand on, how those parties are divided, is something that I think is very much up in the air right now. And I guess just to close, look, sometimes we divide things, I think, inaccurately between sort of left and right, progressive, conservative. The two most popular programs in the United States that are affiliated with the government are Medicare and Social Security. These are universal public goods that everybody loves, including Republicans. These are programs that when they came out, they were described not entirely inaccurately as socialist. And these things are issues that thinking about how to expand universal public goods like Medicare and like Social Security are, for me, that's the access that the Democratic Party wants politics to be fought on if it will take a side.
Well, Matt Karp, T.J. Rooney, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. There's a whole other hour or two waiting for discussion with the two of you. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
It was.
It was great. Go to whyy.org. They're shaking hands. whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about the program. Also, if you missed any portion of today's show or you want to hear the whole thing all over again, tune in tonight from 11 until midnight. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.